This is a new voice for a new Scotland.
Welcome to this week's Yes Group Spotlight. This week's talk is coming from Scottish CND, which just shows you don't need to have Yes Group in your name in order to get on the Yes Group Spotlight. Other groups, very welcome. This week's talk coming from Scottish CND is about how to remove the nuclear weapon from Scotland, which I think is something that whatever groups we're in, it's very dear to our hearts. So thanks very much to Scottish CND for sharing this with us.
Right, for those who don't know me, my name is Jay Anderson and I'm the Secretary of SNP CND. And it's my pleasure to welcome you all tonight to our debate on how to block any plan for nuclear weapons remaining on the Clyde after Scottish independence. Our co-host tonight is Valerie Gold, Political Education Officer of SNP Kelvin, presenter on Indie Live Radio and an active member of Pensioners for Indie. So thanks for helping me here, Val. Before we begin, I want to say a word about what SNP CND is. It's a part of Scottish CND, not the SNP. Scottish CND is a non-political organisation, but it does have affiliates from most political parties. I'll leave you to guess which ones are missing. And of course it has affiliations from trade union groups. In fact, the Scottish Trade Union Congress and Scottish CND have worked together on several occasions and jointly published reports like Cancelling Trident, The Economic Consequences for Scotland, and Trident and Jobs, The Case for a Scottish Defence Diversification Agency. Our aim in SNP CND is to keep the pressure on for Scotland to achieve a nuclear weapon-free, independent Scotland. We're keen in discussing the practical details that get things done, rather than making high-minded statements. We give talks for SNP branches and Yes groups, so anyone's interested really. And we arrange conferences, we run stalls at events, giving out reliable information and selling t-shirts, badges, etc. To join us, you have to be a member of both the SNP and Scottish CND. You can join Scottish CND online at banthebomb.org. And you can contact me to let me know and I'll add you to our mailing list. This event was booked out in a couple of hours when we made it live last week, so we know there's a lot of interest. And because of that, we've arranged two other events on the 20th and the 27th of this month. Both are on Eventbrite. One of the few good things about going online like this is that we have people from all around Scotland. And tonight we've got people from Ullapool to the borders, from Elgin to Loch Gilphead. We even have people registered from Canada, Ireland and Sweden. So welcome to you all. No more complaints about us confining yourself to the central belt all the time, Aaron. Right, on to tonight's event. The format is that each of our four speakers will talk for about 5 minutes, outlining what they think are the most important topics in this topic. And the rest of the event will be questions from you all and answers from the panel. Because there are 100 of us here tonight, or maybe, there's not 100 arrived yet, but there's 100 people now registered, each question is going to have to be fairly short. I won't hesitate to mute a mic if anyone tries to make too long a speech. We're here to give questions and opinions, and also to hear from our four experts, who are Bill Ramsay, SNP convener. Give us a wave, Bill.
SNP CND
convener, oops. Isabel Lindsay, Scottish CND Vice Chair. Isabel. Martin Doherty Hughes MP, who's on the SNP Defence Team in Westminster. And Gail Lithgow, an international law specialist. So make yourselves known to folk. Thank you. So let us begin. Firstly, we have Bill Ramsay, our SNP CND convener. Until the end of June, Bill was president of the EIS. That's Scotland's main and apparently the world's oldest teachers' trade union. Bill now serves for another year as one of its three principal office bearers with the title ex-president. Bill has a background in history and politics. He's a regular contributor of thought pieces on independence and defence, and is the author, of course, of tonight's article, Guantanamo on the Clyde, which is the basis of tonight's discussion. And here he is to introduce that paper to us tonight. Over to you, Bill.
Thanks, Chief.
the re-establishment of a sovereign Scottish state is not far off. I think we can all agree in that. As such, it's time for the membership of the main political vehicle in that re-establishment to start to consider some of the international issues that will need to be resolved. One of them is the removal of nuclear weapons from Scotland. The starting point is to understand that the most important diplomatic relationship an independent Scotland will be with the remaining UK. When we consider any diplomatic relationship, one has to consider the needs of the other. Whether or not you agree with the needs of the other is a factor, but you must start by recognising that they exist and you have to examine them. That's what lies at the heart of this paper. In this paper, I assert that the remaining UK will want to retain its seat on the United Nations Security Council. It will want to retain its position as a medium-sized nuclear power. Under these circumstances, it will wish to retain Trident. And if they can't get away with that, and if they can get away with it, retain the Vanguard fleet on the Clyde. And if they can get away with that, retain the new Dreadnought class, which will become operational when the Vanguard fleet leaves service. And the important point about that is, like the Hunter Killer fleets, all of the Vanguards won't go in a one-hour, and all the Dreadnoughts won't come in a one-hour. Will be replaced one after the other. As the first Dreadnought becomes operational, one of the Vanguards will be taken out and slipped in. So that can be a factor as well. At the heart of such a contingency plan that the Royal Navy will have, they'll be wanting to rent the two facilities from the Scottish Government. The Majesty's Naval Base Clyde and the Royal Naval Armistice Depot in Coolport, and probably some other infrastructure as well related to that, but certainly those two. Now, that's the key point. They will want to come up with, they will be developing, in my view, a contingency plan on that, despite what they say, and there is evidence of that I'll point out as I go on. Now, an important point to understand is for any military, contingency planning is normal, it's bread and butter stuff, it's what they actually do. And it's an entirely rational thing to do. If I were Bill Ramsey, president somewhere down south, and I believed in the concept of multilateralism for Britain, then I would be expecting my government to be planning a contingency. But I wouldn't be as naive as to expect them to admit it. Because viewed from a unionist perspective, to publicly endorse such planning, or worse, to admit that such planning is already being overtaken, would be, from their point of view, politically foolhardy. Such a public admission would lead the UK to losing control of any future independent Scottish independence narrative, something that worked hard to control in the run-up to 2014, with its too isolated narratives. Now, it struggled with that, but it definitely tried to impose that narrative in certain media outlets that mentioned at the moment, and played their dishonourable part in punting that narrative. As I say, contingency planning is a key element, indeed the bread and butter work of all professional staff officers. In peacetime, military staffs are involved continually in planning for contingencies of all types, whether likely contingencies or even sometimes the very unlikely. However, any claims that the notion of planning for the retention of Trident and the Clyde in the event of Scottish independence belongs to the realms of conspiracy theory is simply not credible. And this is because such narratives are already starting to emerge among some commentators with links to the military. And for those of you that download the paper, and Jill will remind you later on where you can get it, under footnote 1, you can find those which publicly talked about. Moreover, planning alternative basing arrangements, whether temporary or permanent, has always been a core function of all naval planners. The notion that the Royal Navy does not do alternative base contingency planning is, in the literal sense of the word, incredible. Indeed, given the anti-nuclear consensus of the SNP, having a discussion around their likely attempts of trade retention in the Clyde would, in the view of SNP, which is not seen as particularly controversial, and in that sense, what we're doing tonight is in a sense nothing new. The process we're using is nothing new. After all, we put forward a motion to the 18 conference on a roadmap for for nuclear disarmament, based in the main around a series of documents that had been done, peer-reviewed documents, that had been done by the late John Ainslie of a Scottish CND. And after having done that, the roadmap paper, having produced the motion, we then made it public to SNP members like yourselves and SNP branches and said, take away the motion, consider it, you might want to amend it to some extent, and feel free to submit something along these lines to party conference, because as far as we're concerned, it's for you and other members and branches to consider the motion that appears towards the end of the document, take it, have a think about it, take it to your branches and consider, are we interested in this motion, are we interested in having a discussion about it, are we interested in its terms, maybe we want to change the terms a bit, and take it forward as a motion and put it to standing orders. Now, the idea of, behind this idea of the plan to retain Trident, it's what I'll call as the boiling frog fable. A colleague of mine in the EIS, who's a primary teacher, explained the concept of the boiling frog, which I hadn't heard of until about a year and a half ago. And it may not be true, but apparently she said you put a frog in a pot of cold water, turn up the heat, and slowly make it warmer and warmer and warmer, and because of the metabolism of the frog, it will eventually boil. True or not, I suppose it's the reverse of salami slicing. And in that sense, boiling the Scottish frog in this case would consist of, it would start from a perfectly reasonable position that the Vanguard cut submarines that carry the Trident missiles could not be expected to up anchor and sail away to Devonport or some such the morning after the vote of the night before. I mean, that's simply not credible. I don't think anybody would expect that to be a credible option. And that's an entirely reasonable expectation at one end of a very, very long continuum that has, at the other, a decades-long lease to host the Vanguard class replacements until well into the second half of the 21st century. That's at the other end of the scale. In between would be more gradual steps, including a short-term lease of Fas Lane for over 10 years or more. There are complications around gradual disengagement from the Clyde. It's not the only matter to be considered. I believe of more importance are the incentives that would be offered to establish a British Guantanamo on the Clyde. That will almost certainly happen, is that an offer will be made to pay a rental cost for Fas Lane that will cover the entire or almost entire Scottish defence budget of an independent Scotland. But simply, it is now becoming clear that proposals that a future Scottish Defence Force of modest size is no longer incurring opprobrium, indeed ridicule, that it once did from the British military commentariat. And again, you'll find the references to that in the article. In the run-up to MDRF1, the Royal United Services Institute published a paper called All the Blue Bonnets, Defending an Independent Scotland, written by Lieutenant Colonel retired Stuart Crawford and his colleague Richard Marsh. In it, the authors presented a quite comprehensive and credible force structure for Scotland's armed forces. And again, the reference to that is in the paper. However, it fell foul of the constituents' interests of the then Westminster leader Angus Robertson. Scottish Government's white paper proposals saw Scotland retain a fast jet capability in this constituency. This produced a financially top-heavy commitment of keeping a minimum of 12 fast jets as part of the Scottish Defence Force structure. On the other hand, Crawford and Marsh proposals suggested the fast jet capability be abandoned. I mean, they suggested that it might be covered by a NATO base with other NATO countries providing that. A cursory glance at a map, and I'm not asking you to put it up, Gene, at the moment, will illustrate why. Every time a couple of aging Russian bombers appear in the North Sea, they've already been handed on through Finnish, then Swedish, then the Norwegian military controllers, not to mention whatever assets the United States Navy has in the Barents Sea and the Norwegian seas at the time. Interestingly, although the Royal United Services Institute and indeed Westminster engaged with Crawford and Mars, the Scottish Government did not. This time around it may be different, not least as the constituency calculus of 2021 has changed a little since 2024. With a probability near certainty of NDRF 2, Crawford and March are understandably in the process of updating their proposals for a Scottish Defence Force. And they've publicly said that in many fora, and again, that's reference. The NDRF white paper proposal had a defence budget of around 2.5 billion as a figure that would have had Scotland in the ratio of GDP to defence spending terms as a big defence spender. We can be confident with recent comments of Crawford and March that their updated paper will have a budget considerably well below that. And as I've already indicated, there are already calls that rental of FAS Lane and Coolport to the Royal Navy should be considered. Nuclear multilateralists will argue that we have the UK over a barrel, that we should take the money for a short time, call it for a longer time, and for others for as long as the UK has nuclear weapons. Now, I've not heard any SNP elected politicians say that, but I've certainly heard some SNP members over the years talk about it. But more importantly, in some terms, some of the commentariat are already saying that. The likes of Trevor Royal, who is a military historian, Scottish military historian. In fact, his recent book on Scotland and NATO is actually quite good, I've got a copy of it. But more to the point, in the sense, even Trevor, who won't be known to the wider SNP members yet, Jerry Hassan, I mean, he's said this as well, and so did Pat Kane, but Pat Kane said it more tongue-in-cheek. Now, Marsh and Crawford haven't quite said that, but those who comment on their papers say it, so it's already out there. So SNP CMD are the view that the SNP needs to develop a policy this side of the 2021 election so that when the SNP seek a mandate for independence referendum, the SNP policy makes it clear the SNP will not negotiate a lease of Fast Lane and Coolport. SNP CMD will once again, as we did with the last motion, seek sponsorship of a motion for the next SNP National Conference for the following motion. Clearly the discourse around the timescale is crucial, but as a democratic political party, SNP CND of faith, if such a motion were considered by a properly constituted SNP conference, a motion not dissimilar to the draft below would emerge. Now, some of you may well have downloaded the paper, but some of you have not. So I'll read out the motion to you at the moment. It's not long, only consists of 2 points. The conference reaffirms its policy. The roadmap for Trident removal as accepted in 2018. Conference therefore sets SNP policy a timescale of 3 calendar years after the declaration of the result of a successful Scottish independence referendum for the removal of the Trident missile system and their launch plan, a platform, the Vanguard class submarines, as a first step. Now I'll conclude with this point. Why 3 years? One, it's about the shortest credible timescale that you could remove the boats from the Clyde to take somewhere. But secondly, if one is negotiating, and as some of you may appreciate, I've just finished as EIS president, I was vice president the year before, when, and I've just used it as an example, when the EIS started its pay campaign, where we managed to negotiate a 13% pay award, when we went to our members, about a year before we started to look outwards to the government and to the general public, we engaged with our wider membership. We clearly said to them why we reckoned that they're entitled to the pay, to a pay, a substantial pay increase. We didn't have difficulty selling them that. And we put a figure Now the figure was 20%, and I can remember at certain meetings, certain members saying, we know that you're talking less than 20%. We demand 20% as the end of it. But the point is, unless you put down a sound negotiating figure at the beginning, then it will be eroded. That's for certain. And therefore, you have to, you start with the baseline, and 3 years is actually credible. And then you go to the other side and say, well, what position, where are you going to come to in this? Because the final point to make is, what I don't think we will see is that a unit of the Royal Marines being taken from somewhere and plonked into Fazley in the morning after the night before, and suddenly, you know, the Union Jack being hoisted up at every flagpole, and them saying, you know, this will remain a sovereign base of the United Kingdom forever and ever. I mean, if they were to do that, forget about the reaction in Scotland. The reaction in England would be, shall we say, mixed. I mean, many people, the idea of an occupation force suddenly occupying somewhere else, although it will still be sovereign territory of the UK to start with before independence, but the idea of occupying it by military force would be seen as unacceptable both in England and internationally. So we're not talking about that. Moreover, England will want to establish a good relationship with an independent Scotland. That's an important point we need to make. And one of the points that we made with the last motion is, all of the cards do not sit with the remaining UK. Many of the cards sit with Scotland, and therefore the UK will change its attitude and come up with a negotiating strategy when it comes to negotiation over this. But overall, the main thing is that you, the SNP members, start to think about it. You, the SNP members, need to discuss it in your branches, and you, the SNP members, need to put forward a motion along the lines of what we have to a conference. We know that such a motion would be quite popular. After all, a previous motion, when it got through the list of 24 motions or so something that standing orders decided would put to the wider, I think it was more than that, to the wider membership in 2018. And the wider membership who are going to conference, some thousand, were then asked, how would you rank the motions for discussion? And our Trident roadmap motion was number two in the list. I can't remember what number one was. It was a Scottish Government worthy motion about something, not decrying it. But our motion was number two in the list. So if this motion was coming from a few branches, a variation of this, then as would happen the last time, it would become public knowledge that such a motion is being proposed, and we would expect that to be quite high on the list. There are various other points we can cover over the discussions, including the point that Peter Henderson made in his discussion just there, but I'll leave it at that. Thanks.
Thanks very much, Bill. Lots of food for thought there. Next we have Isabel Lindsay. Isabel is a Scottish CND Vice Chair. She's a peace activist and a supporter of Scottish independence who's been in the thick of things since the 1960s. Isabel was one of the original signatories of the Committee of 100. She was Vice Chair of the SNP in 1972, and she was a founding member of the cross-party campaign for a Scottish Assembly in the early 80s. That's what paved the way for the Constitutional Convention and ultimately the new Scottish Parliament. Isabel's still a prime actor in the fight for independence and for disarmament, and we're glad to be able to rely on her experience and advice. Isabel.
Okay, thanks. Well, I think there is quite a simple message, quite a clear message, that we can project to the Scottish people as well as the political activists. And the first thing is, yes, the same starting point as Bill, that of course the whole question of Trident, Tasmanian Pool Court will be at the top of the transition priorities in negotiations with the remainder of the UK. And that's one reason why we have to have a negotiating strategy that is very, very clear. There is a very, very tough timetable, and we announce it long in advance, so that right through the period leading up to a referendum and then on to the transition negotiations, people know where we stand. And they know that on certain basics, there is no wriggle room. That's very, very important in negotiation. Now, we know Trident is of no relevance, actually, to the rest of the UK's defence or security. It has a lot of relevance, as their leaders perceive it, in the UK status. So, you know, that's what really is being negotiated for. And the crucial thing is, yes, of course, the tactic in negotiations is going to be probably to say, oh, be reasonable, we have to have time, we need 15 years, and reckoning that if they can get 10 years, even a bit less than 10 years, then they're home and dry, because after 5 years, after 10 years, they'll assume, well, everything is so taken for granted and established that we're there for as long as we want, which is why we have got to deal with it right at the start. And the issue is not that I think we have to prioritise, is not getting rid of the submarines, it is getting rid of all the nuclear warheads. And that is actually quite a straightforward thing. We know exactly how to do it. And that's what we've got to prioritise. That's what we've got to say is the first thing that we do. And it can be started almost right away, and it can be completed within 2 years. Now, the process there is just that we make that clear, that all nuclear warheads must be removed from Scotland. The question of when the hulks go, subs go, when the non-nuclear armed submarines go, that's open to negotiations. But when the warheads go, that is not. And that means that Trident cannot be operational with nuclear warheads from Paisley Pool Court or in Scottish territory. Now, the reason why I say this is a fairly straightforward thing, both to project to the public and to SNP membership and others, is because the transportation of warheads is done regularly. We know this, unfortunately, at probably considerable public risk. The reason why it will need 1 to 2 years is because you can only transport them by road safely. You would only want to do this, you can take the triggers off at Coolport, this is done all the time, but you would only want to transport them about half a dozen at a time. There are probably about 200 warheads that will have to be moved. So you have to do this in a more gradual way over 1 to 2 year period. Now, what the rest of the UK state decides to do with it, I would hope there will be pressure building up from England and elsewhere to try to decide that what they should do is move to a non-nuclear basis. But that's not something that we can decide. They have to find a home for these warheads. And again, some of them will go to Burfield, where they manufacture, but they have to find another store. Probably RAF Honington, which has done this historically in the past, has stored warheads, would be an appropriate place. They would have the time, because we will have said this, as soon as Scotland votes yes, we will have made this clear, this is what the policy will be. So there'll be a couple of 2 to 3 transition years for them to prepare this. Now, once we get that done, once we get that underway, once we say this is non-negotiable, the rest can be negotiated in terms of timescale, but that's the crucial thing. Now, we are helped here, and perhaps Gail will take this up, by the fact that by the time we're independent, the treaty on the prohibition of nuclear weapons will be a formal UN treaty. And there's already been a clear indication that there will be political support. The SNP has supported it, the Greens have supported it, there are some people within Labour who will support it. So there is a clear political support for that, for joining that treaty. And that treaty has specific provisions for countries which have the nuclear weapons of another state on their territory. And it doesn't give a precise timescale, but it says as soon as possible. And you have to submit the timescale, and the other member states will decide on a deadline for the completion of the removal of nuclear weapons. And remember, that is removal of the weapons. We're not talking about ancillary things like the subs, or even the missiles, if the missiles have no warheads. So we would have this international structure in which to proceed. And we should remember that in all negotiations, what happens is that if you think there's a bit of the door open, then you push and push and use every negotiating tool to get there, you know, to get your continued use of Faslane Pool Port. But if the door is absolutely glued shut, you know you're wasting your time. And therefore, you go on to negotiate in other ways and get other kinds of concession as best as you can. But that initial thing of removing all the warheads from Scottish territory, if that door is glued shut and they know it early on, that is the key, the important key. And it's also quite a straightforward and popular message to send. And what I would say on this is that, of course, we can't determine what happens in the rest of the UK, what decisions they will make. But I'm sure that by doing this, we would open a huge debate in England and huge pressure to change the nuclear position. How it would come out, I don't know, but it would certainly change things in a very important way. And it would be a defining moment internationally for a newly independent Scotland, because we would have shown we had principles, we had nerve, we had a clear strategy for our future, and it would be enormously important politically, as well as enormously important in achieving significant disarmament. Thank you.
Thank you. That was excellent and very cheering, Isabel. Thank you very much for that. Our next speaker is Martin Doherty Hughes, MP. Martin's been a member of Clydebank SNP since 1990, since he was a boy. He was elected to Clydebank District Council, aged 21, in 1992, and then Glasgow City Council in 2012. He's been MP for Western Bartonshire since 2015, and he's a member of the SNP Westminster Defence Team and also the Westminster Select Committee. And we're very grateful for him joining us tonight and look forward to hearing his comments. Over to you, Martin.
Well, Jean, thanks very much for the invite to join the panel tonight and have this, what I think is mostly an agreeable discussion on the removal of weapons of mass destruction from the Clyde. When you asked me originally as to start my bio, I made it quite clear as to being a councillor in Clydebank and being a branch member of Clydebank, and specifically for a very specific reason, about the lived experience of my community on the impact of aerial bombardment and mass loss of life. And next year is the 80th anniversary of the Clydebank Blitz, in which we commemorate some of the family that I lost, that my parents lost, and the decimation of our town by National Socialism. And the commitment that brought me into the SNP a long time ago, the running joke in my branch is when I had hair and my own teeth, is our commitment not only to the liberty of our country, but also to removal of Trident. And so far, with what Isabel's been saying in Bill, there's quite a lot there which I fundamentally agree with, and I suppose the vast majority of the members of the Scottish National Party agree with as well. But I wanted maybe to take up a couple of points that I think are worth discussing around. I think what Bill has been mentioning around this kind of Guantanamoisation of Faz Lane, and I think some folks have been also already been putting in the chat about how the UK already has sovereign military establishments in the world, and indeed there is a fact. I think one of the big differences around Faz Lane from my perspective is that it is a nuclear location, and from my knowledge that there's not one nuclear power in the world which has a nuclear facility surrounded by the sovereign territory of another country. So I think that's something that we need to consider when we look at that, the issues that the UK will face when they're doing their contingency planning. And Bill's right around the issue around the MOD, or as they like to call it, main building, in terms of the contingency planning. I'm sure they will be thinking about it, but I don't think they'll be thinking about it very well, because it is a chaotic, I have to say at the moment, a very chaotic place, in which there are a range of conflicting ministerial and departmental issues in terms around the integrated defence review at this time. And we will find in the UK, or should I say the remainder of the UK, what remains of the UK, is that the impact of the removal of Trident from Scotland, most importantly, and I think for all of us, I think from moving from the moral position of removing nuclear weapons from Scotland to the practical element, is it's not just about, it won't just remove nuclear weapons from Scotland. For me, it will most certainly remove weapons from the rest of what remains of the UK, because they can't afford it at the moment, and they certainly won't be able to afford it in the not too distant future. And some of even their own political, their own military theorists will say that at the Defence Select Committee. I think there's also another issue that Bill touched on is some of the narrative of commentators. And I understand where people like the Crawford March report, but I think that's up to members of the Scottish National Party, and I think not members of other political parties, to determine the future or to create policy papers. And we have been consistent in the SNP for a long time about our position is the removal of Trident from the Clyde, and specifically the turning of Faz Lane into a Scottish military establishment. Now, some folk may want to discuss the idea of having a military establishment or anything else, but in terms of the removal of Trident, it is essential for the removal of Trident for us to have our tri-services headquarters at Faz Lane. And I think Isabel had mentioned the issue that Faz Lane itself is not an effective nuclear facility. And the UK military establishment know this. I noticed that Ken had put up, I'm hoping jokingly, you know, we'll just float, you know, just sink a couple of boats and block it off. Well, in practicalities, that could be done by an adversary in terms of the use of the continuous at-sea nuclear deterrent, as they like to call it. That it is probably one of the most ineffective nuclear bases that exists. I think also in terms of the Guantanamoisation element, my only kind of, what I would throw into this is that it would therefore, I'm imagining that with us being, again, a sovereign independent state, and I am hoping, but I'm not assuming how the Scottish electorate would vote after independence, that we have a government which is anti-nuclear, that anti-nuclear government is not going to be very happy about a sovereign nuclear base in its own territory in which those nuclear weapons, as Isabel so clearly pointed out, are taken by truck down through the central belt of Scotland, through not only Argyll and Bute, but through my constituency, through Dumbarton, through Clydebank, I can't imagine for a minute that the UK is thinking that is a reasonable position in which to place a military, nuclear military establishment, because I know that we as a movement, I would hope SNP, CND would be very vocal in if that should ever come to pass. And I certainly could never imagine that happening under an SNP government, but it's not just the SNP who would run for office. Maybe, because I know we're running for time, around some of the other issues about in terms of withdrawal. And I go back to that kind of perilous document of the late John Lindsay's, John Ainslie's, you know, about disarming Trident. And his document is very succinct, but I know when I look at it, and it informs a lot of our thinking as a party, is it is not based on what is actually on the ground within that base. Because they haven't, that none of that information is available in the public domain. And I do agree with Isabel that, you know, in terms of the actual physical warheads, but we're only assuming that's the only reality in terms of the practicalities. So we don't know the entirety of it. So whereas I agree with Bill around the possibility of saying, you know, there will be no lease in an independent Scotland, I think we need to give ourselves just that little bit of flexibility in terms of time to make sure it's based on the reality. Because for me at least, I don't know about others, but our moral imperative is to move that moral imperative of removing Trident, not just from Scotland, but taking the opportunity to make sure it doesn't go anywhere else. Though saying that, I just maybe want to finish on this before there's questions, etc., is that what remains of the UK, and again, it's Isabel who intimated this in terms of why they have nuclear weapons, sitting at the top of the UN, at the Security Council, you know, as you know, it is a rather large phallic symbol, forgive me for saying, that they like to kind of wave around, is that they may decide to place it within one of their allies who are nuclear powers, notably, for example, in Norfolk, in the East Coast United States. And whilst they may do it with France, I doubt they would, because the French have a completely independent nuclear deterrent as opposed to what the UK has. So just to finish, what I'm saying is, I think there needs to be a degree of flexibility and timing, not too much, I have to say, based on the reality of what's inside the base. I think the SNP is clear, committed, and always has been, is that Faslane will be a tri-services headquarters for our armed forces and will not be some, you know, UK, remainder UK island in a sea of non-nuclear states. But actually what I should have just maybe finish on is how we take this forward after independence to making sure that what SNP, CND and predominantly Scottish CND have been doing is to make sure that not only Scotland is a nuclear-free nation, but every other nation in the world becomes one, critically around non-proliferation, the United States pushing for more nuclear weapons, China in terms of more nuclear weapons, the Russian Federation, and no doubt the French as well. And we have a lot of work after independence. It's not just about us being nuclear free, it's maintaining that commitment within the party and processing it to make sure that our allies and our friends realise, forgive me, the stupidity of weapons of mass destruction. Thanks, Jean.
Thank you very much, Martin. I'm sure those are sentiments that we can all agree with. It's stupidity indeed. Our final speaker tonight is Gail Lithgow. Gail's a member of the Executive Committee of Scottish CND, but she's also an international law specialist. She's currently working at the University of Glasgow, and she's written widely on boundaries and territories in international law and enforced population displacement. Having your expertise in this debate is very welcome. So thank you for joining us, Gail, and over to you. There you go.
I've got it. Yeah, I wrestled control. Well, thank you so much, everyone, for having me. I guess my role after the three talks we've had so far is to maybe provide some clarification over the idea of territory, that given that's my main background, but also the idea of sovereign base areas and leasing, etc., because these are all very distinct and very important and will be the difference between Faslane and Coalport turning into Guantanamo or not. So I'm going to talk about three main things. One is the different options, and then I'm going to discuss their implications and what they mean for the Scottish Government, and then what the role for Scottish CND should be, and the role for SNP and Green CND, because I think they have a particular role in keeping pressure up with the different categories of audiences. So first of all, in terms of the different options, you'll see, if anyone's read the John Ainslie report, which is excellent, you should read it. And if you've read Bill Ramsey's paper, which again is very clear, I just want to make some clarifications, because sovereign base areas and leases and colonial possessions are all very different things. It's Fas Lane and Coolport would not turn into a colonial possession if the UK was to retain sovereignty over that area, mainly because, and people might disagree, there's definitely a debate, Scotland is not colonised in the way that it's understood in international law anyway. The second idea of sovereign base areas, I mean, the implications of sovereign base areas are very concerning for the Scottish government, the Scottish people. And I noticed there was an SNP councillor who said that they were the most likely scenario, and I would absolutely urge that they are not the likely scenario, and they're very different from leasing. But sovereign base areas exist in the likes of Cyprus, as many of you know, and they are not technically part of the UK, but they are subject to the sovereignty of the United Kingdom. And what happened was, when Cyprus became independent, an act was passed in the UK Parliament which decided to give Cyprus the entirety of the island apart from the two areas that they still retain a sovereignty over. And so these are subject to the sovereignty and jurisdiction of the United Kingdom. Cyprus cannot get them back unless the UK wants to get them back, or unless they're able to argue that they should be decolonized. But given that there was permission given for these sovereign base areas to exist in the first place, it's going to become a lot more difficult. And so the international law that then applies is that relating to British overseas territory. And so British overseas territories do not need to be handed back if there is consent. And the difference here is with the Chagos Islands, which many of you will have heard of, which are in the sea, and Mauritius is trying to get them back. And so these are, the UK has sovereignty and jurisdiction over them. And they're different from Fas Lane because they were clearly part of colonization in the 18th and 19th century. Whereas Scotland is not seen as colonised. So these would be different again from how decolonisation and handing back exists with regards to Chagos. Now, leasing is when we start entering Guantanamo territory. So Guantanamo is not a sovereign base area of the US. Leasing is where we start heading into potential kind of Guantanamo style arrangements if the Scottish government were to end up negotiating or agreeing to that. And so a lease of territory in international law is basically when one state accepts that another state can have the right to use and exercise control over that space. Sovereignty, however, would remain with Scotland, and it then becomes divorced jurisdictionally. So the rest of the UK would have jurisdiction over Fas Lane and Coolport, but they would not have sovereignty. Quite famous that for Cuba, for example, they've only cashed one check from the United States in that entire time, mainly because they don't want it to be seen as a lease agreement. They're wanting to argue that it's a colonial possession, and there's a bit of ambiguity about that. The scope of this lease is utterly up for negotiation. The length of time, the powers that the rest of the United Kingdom would have as a result, the obligations that the UK and the rest of the UK and Scotland would have in the lease, and the duration of it. And so we would then, this is when we start talking about timescale. And so it's really important that when we think about the 3 years after independence, that already comes after 18 months of negotiation. 18 months was what was in the Scotland's future last time around, and it's quite likely that 18 months makes sense. So we're actually talking 3 years plus 18 months, so 4.5 years would already be a kind of a reasonable timescale. If we were to accept a lease for 3 years, what becomes then especially important for the Scottish Government to determine is how that lease may be renewed or renegotiated. So the problem with Guantanamo is that Cuba cannot unilaterally agree or cannot unilaterally end that lease. And there's actually no fixed expiration date. There needs to be agreement between both states in Guantanamo in order for that lease to end. And I mean, that would just be daft if the Scottish Government were to agree to this. That's how we would end in a Guantanamo situation. So absolutely vital that the negotiations, if there was a lease, the negotiations were to say that each party must agree to it, that the lease is renewed as opposed to that the lease comes to an end. So, and leases could be any length of time really in international law. The longest one that I can remember is 99 years. It was one of the recent ones where China's leasing ports from the likes of Sri Lanka for 99 years. And this is quite common in their Belt and Road Initiative across the world. But yeah, basically, they're very different from sovereign base areas. And the key part is that ultimate sovereignty would remain with Scotland. And a lease, rather than a sovereign base area, allows the Scottish Government to have a much larger voice in negotiation. But all leases are individual, and the Scottish Government would have to negotiate every single part of the terms of that lease. So I think that's the most important thing to understand, and I do not advocate at all. The implications of a sovereign base area would be so limiting for the Scottish Government in the future that it would be one of the most worrying situations. And that's where Isabel is 100% right. Negotiation is one of the most important things. Negotiations are never symmetrical. So there's always one party that tends to be more powerful in one area or another. And so the Scottish Government needs to be really careful in how they undertake that negotiation. And then there is, of course, an option where there's no official lease, but the Scottish Government agree with the UK government, the rest of the UK government, that they can be removed within a certain time period. Now, the UK government is not going to like that because they're going to want full control and jurisdiction, which a lease will be able to give them, while Trident is being removed from Faslane and the warheads are removed from Coolport. But the Scottish Government doesn't need to give them a lease. It can refuse it. It is completely up then to the Scottish Government to set the terms like that. So I think those are the main things I want to highlight in terms of the different options and the implications and what that means about the Scottish Government's position, or what the Scottish Government's position should be. And I just want to very kind of quickly and lastly touch on what should the Scottish CND's position be. And I absolutely think that because negotiation is so important, then we need to think, as Scottish CND, as SNP CND, that we have about three main categories of parties that we need to monitor and pressure. One is Scottish political parties and civil service. The other one is the rest of the UK. And the third will sure that the negotiation, and that wherever possible, political parties have their own policies over how long the lease could possibly exist for. And the reason why I say have policy now is it allows the UK government to understand what the likely negotiating position is going to be in the future. But I also think we need to be careful, even if, for example, we don't have a second independence referendum, what various Scottish governments sign up to in relation to Coolport and Faslane. Simply because if we start formally changing the way in which the naval bases operate, we might actually be handing over sovereign power towards them, for the rest of the UK government. So I think we need to be careful, even if there's no independence referendum, how replacements of Trident and the almost like the property law behind naval bases in the UK, we need to keep an eye out for what the UK government might be doing surrounding that. So I'm happy to answer any questions. This is a very kind of quick kind of pit stop tour of all the most important kind of legal positions and what they will mean and the implications that they have for what the Scottish Government's negotiation position should be, and then why I think party policy is so key to ensuring that we start making what the negotiation positions should be up front. And yeah, we can have quite the party policies don't need to say 3 years. They can say, for example, not longer than 5 years or not longer. So we are giving a different time frame, which might be more realistic, and also kind of show our maturity as negotiators, etc. So these are kind of really key points, and I think we need to pay attention to them now rather than another independence referendum is announced. Thank you.
Thanks again to Scottish CND for sharing that event with us. And if anybody else in a Yes group or other similar groups has an event that you'd like to share on the Yes group spotlight, please get in touch with us. We've got a dedicated email address now for the show, which is spotlight@indylive.radio. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you again next week for another Yes group spotlight. Indylive.radio.